Now, with this statement as a background, that is, that the plan of the Perleone family was, the objective of it was, the papacy, we turn again to the history of Benedict, which, as we shall see, gave content and meaning to the Perleone family ambition. The announcement that he intended to marry his cousin certainly staggered the establishment of that time, and required, as was pointed out to Benedict by the Archdeacon of the Church of St. John, that Benedict would have to abdicate as Pope, a step which even the carefree Benedict did not appear too willing to take. However, Benedict did abdicate. And the circumstances surrounding the abdication were no less extraordinary than the act itself. It is reliably reported that John Gratian Perleone paid to have Benedict vacate the papacy and to be elected to that office in his place. And while this may appear to be more in the realm of fiction than reality, the fact of the matter is that historians have set the price for this transaction at about £6,000 sterling, a considerable sum of money even in the 11th century. And so the first Jewish pope bought control of the papacy, and there can be very little doubt that his short reign of just under 1 year did much to reform the decaying Roman Church. The papal exchequer was empty. The buildings were a sacred trust of Christendom. They were in need of repair. The ancient church of St. Peter itself had been so neglected for so long that it was dangerous even to hold services there. All these needs, of course, were physical needs, and while Pope Gregory the VI, as the first Jewish pope was called, saw to these matters, it is reported in Cambridge Medieval History that Gregory was very much aware of the need for reform within the Roman priesthood itself. After laying the foundation for both the physical and the spiritual reforms, the infusion, of course, of considerable Perleone monies contributed no small measure towards this, Gregory found himself on the horns of a dilemma, because Benedict's marital plans had not succeeded, and he was pressing for a return to Rome, while certain others of the nobility were a little alarmed at the reforms being suggested by Gregory, which could deprive them of further lucrative incomes. The upshot of it all was that Henry III, the as yet uncrowned emperor, left Germany with a large army, crossed the Brenner Pass, and entered Italy, and although he was met and welcomed at Piacenza by Gregory and there received the papal benediction, Henry, apart from receiving him with honor, did little else to resolve the situation of two popes being alive at the same time with both aspiring to the throne of Peter. Henry was, of course, more than a little disturbed at the procedures in electing the pope, and he resented the fact that as emperor he was merely called upon to confirm the people's choice. And in this matter of Gregory and Benedict, Henry drew attention to the part that money had played in the installation of Gregory, plus, of course, the fact that he, as emperor, was not called upon to ratify the people's choice. Stricken by the accusations against him, Gregory, so we are told, vacated the papacy and was succeeded by the Bishop of Bamberg, who adopted the name of Clement II when he was elected as Pope. Now, Hildebrand, another member of the Perleone family, became Pope Gregory the VII in 1073 and administered papal affairs for roughly 12 years, and it was in his reign that the Perleone family were established very, very firmly as papal bankers and the protectors of the popes. He died in 1085 and was succeeded by Honorius II, who reigned for 45 years and was replaced by Peter Perleone, who, when he assumed the papacy, used the name of Anaclet or Anacletus II, reigning for 8 years. Now, why, one may ask, apart from fulfilling the Perleone family plan to occupy the papacy, did three Jewish popes bother with the Roman Church, when in point of fact it was on the point of decay and total collapse, and without which involvement there would have been no Roman Church today? The question is somewhat difficult to answer fully with undeniable historical confirmation. Those times, that is, the Middle Ages, are marked by what is called cover-up programs, so that we do not really have a fully authenticated sequence of events. For instance, this period marks the beginning of the Crusades, and although our reference books claim that the Crusades were military expeditions organized by Western Christian nations against the Muslim powers in order to take possession of or to maintain control over Jerusalem and the places associated with the life and the mission of our Lord Jesus Christ, while this is so, no one apparently tells who it was who first mooted the idea of a Christian campaign in Palestine. As far as Christianity generally was concerned, remembering, of course, that it was mainly a Gentile organization which had nothing to do with Palestine or its events, Gentile Christianity felt absolutely nothing for Palestine. Rome, after all said and done, was the center of its faith, and with the supposed vicar of Christ sitting upon Peter's supposed throne, what need was there for a campaign to liberate a land which meant, while quite a lot to the Jews, but very little to the Gentiles? However, if we follow the recorded history of the Per Leone Hildebrand, Pope Gregory VII, we find that among the many plans which he had in the pipeline was the ambition to unite a then very much divided Christendom. One of the ways in which he hoped to achieve this was through a united campaign to liberate Jerusalem from the hands of the infidel Turks. And although there is no evidence that he ever attempted to get this plan off the ground, as it were, it nevertheless remained as one of his ambitions, and being a Jew, we can perhaps understand how he felt about Palestine. To continue with the events in those far-off times, as they led up to the Crusades, Gregory VII, in his struggle with the German king Henry IV, found it necessary to excommunicate him, and in subsequent history, we find that although the king accepted his excommunication and begged Gregory for forgiveness on his hands and knees, Henry continued to harbor a hatred for this pope who had humiliated him before the population of Rome. With the passage of time, Henry grew militarily very strong, so much so that he attacked Rome and forced Gregory to take refuge in the San Angelo Tower, which was a stronghold built by the Per Leone family sometime earlier. Henry then issued a proclamation annulling Gregory's appointment as pope, and then proceeded to induct Clement III as pope, thus creating the situation where two living popes confronted each other, the one living in St. Peter's and the other within a stone's throw away in the San Angelo Tower. Gregory, of course, refused to accept Henry's decree nullifying his papal position, and until his death in 1085, Gregory insisted that he was the legitimate successor to the throne of Peter. Just before his death, Gregory nominated Desiderius of Monte Cassino as his successor, who in the spring of 1086 was installed as Pope Victor III, but whose tenure in office lasted just under a year. By this time, the Per Leone militia had retaken St. Peter's and had driven out the Henry-sponsored Clement, who passes out of history to a fate which is certainly not recorded in our textbooks. Following the death of Victor III, Gregory's second choice of a successor, Otto of Ostia, came into effect, and when he was proclaimed as Pope in 1088, he took the name of Urban II. Following in Gregory's footsteps, and perhaps influenced by Gregory's unfulfilled plans, Urban convened the Council of Clermont in 1095, and here he set out his plan for the unification of Christendom, which had as a central feature the liberation of Jerusalem. Such was the power of Urban's appeal that the Western nations rallied to his call, and the first crusade, called the People's Crusade, was begun. Now, most prominent in this first crusade was one Godfrey of Boulogne, the only major prince of the German kingdom to take part in this enterprise, and he it was who in 1099 took Jerusalem. At this point, we come up against the first of many problems, which, so far as we know, have no solution. Godfrey was offered a throne, but precisely where this throne was is nowhere stated, nor are we told who it was that made the offer. All that is said is that the offer was made by an anonymous conclave, the leader of which was said to have been of Calabrian origin, which immediately throws us back to Italy and the Pope. For in the late 11th century, a group of monks left Calabria, which of course is in the toe of Italy, and travelled to Palestine, where, after the fall of Jerusalem, they were housed in an abbey which had been built at the behest of Godfrey of Bouillon on Mount Zion, just south of the city of Jerusalem, and from which location the name of Order or Priory of Zion took its name. The monks of Calabria were thus known as the personnel of the Order of Zion. Now, in addition to the creation of the Order of Zion, we find another organization, the Knights Templar, coming into existence, which, so our textbooks tell us, was the military and the administrative arm of the Order of Zion. And although the Knights Templar as such were dissolved in 1314, just 200 years after its founding, the Order, or the Priory of Zion, continued, and still apparently continues, to our present time, and among many other secret organizations, still plays its part in international affairs as well as in the domestic affairs of a certain European countries. This, however, is getting a bit ahead of ourselves. So then, let us get back to the Knights Templar, who were recognized by their uniform, which comprised a white tunic with a splayed red cross. Now, much, of course, has been written about them, both good and bad, with Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe depicting them as haughty, arrogant bullies, greedy and hypocritical despots who shamelessly abused their power, being cunning manipulators, orchestrating the affairs of men and kingdoms. There is, of course, very little to directly link the papacy with the Knights Templar, although, if our records are correct, an indirect link lies with the Order or the Priory of Zion, which comprised those Calabrian monks who left Italy and took up residence on Mount Zion. We do not know, nor is there any evidence to support this, but it is quite possible that the monks of the Order of Zion were used by the Pope to communicate the promised papal rewards to the Knights Templar, rewards which included the remission of all sins, an expiation of penances, an assured place in heaven, and all the booty that they could plunder. There is yet another link which, while it may be considered as merely circumstantial evidence, is well worth repeating here. Now, this circumstantial evidence concerns the story of the Albigensian Crusade. But before we deal with this crusade, I feel that we need to take a look at the pretext under which Pope Innocent III launched his armies against helpless men, women, and children in a 40-year campaign of slaughter in 1209. The territory of what is today considered as southern France, the mountainous northeastern foothills of the Pyrenees, was once an independent principality whose language, culture, and political institutions were such that the rest of Europe, by comparison, was in a state of semi-barbarism. The principality was ruled by a handful of noble families, chief of whom were the Counts of Toulouse and the powerful House of Trencavel. A principality where a culture flourished which was the most advanced and sophisticated in Christendom, with, of course, the possible exception of Byzantium. Like Byzantium, the little principality practiced a civilized, easygoing religious tolerance, which, of course, was in marked contrast to the fanatical zeal that characterized the other parts of papal Europe. And while the Roman Church was very much in evidence in the principality, it certainly did not enjoy the high esteem of the people, who looked askance at the corruption of the clerics, and who wondered when the priests ignored the church and ran businesses or large estates with the monies which had been filched from the parishioners. Now, with this type of lack of leadership, it was small wonder that several sects began to spring up, and other doctrines taught in the place of those Pauline teachings which had previously characterized the Roman Church. Thus, in the light of the new doctrines, which were diametrically opposed to those taught by the Roman priests, it was small wonder that the two words Albigensian and Cathar were used to describe the new and so-called heresies which came to be held and which were growing in popularity among the people. In 1145, that is now just 50 years before the Albigensian Crusade, Bernard of Aosta, later called Saint Bernard, traveled to the little principality to preach against the heretics. But, so says the record, when he arrived at Albi, the little town that gave its name to the Albigensians, he was less appalled by the so-called heretics than by the corruption within the church which he represented. Bernard, after spending some time in the region examining the beliefs of the Cathars and the Albigensians and comparing the morality of those who lived according to those beliefs with that of the priests of the Roman Church, stated that the people outside the church were more Christian than the teachers in the church. By the year 1200, Rome had grown distinctly alarmed by the situation in the independent principality in southern France. And in looking for some excuse to take positive action against the rising tide of rebellion, Pope Innocent III looked to the barons of northern Europe, who were very envious of the rich lands and cities of the south. However, anticipating their assistance in putting down what he called a rebellion and finding sufficient provocation for this were two different things. But on January the 14th, 1208, the necessary provocation was provided in that Pierre de Castelnau, one of the papal legates sent to the principality, was murdered. And without establishing who was responsible, the Pope ordered a crusade against the Albigensians and the Cathars. An army of some 30,000 knights and foot soldiers took to the field, and in the following 40 years reduced the principality of the Languedoc to the same level of barbarity as characterized the remainder of Roman Europe. In this crusade, the knights wore the same white tunic with a splayed red cross which had identified the Knights Templar in Palestine. And when we read of the rewards promised to those knights in the Albigensian Crusade, we see that the rewards were identical: the remission of all sins, expiation of penances, an assured place in heaven, and all the booty from the rich but now ravaged region. Under Simon de Montfort, of course the father of the man who subsequently played so crucial a role in English history, the Pope's Crusaders reduced the highest European culture of the Middle Ages to destitution and rubble, a testimony to the ruthless intolerance of the Roman Church when confronted by opposition. Now, an interesting feature of this time is that the North European Crusaders were aided by a new ally, a Spanish papal fanatic named Dominic Guzman. The name has a Jewish connotation, I feel. Now, Dominic Guzman, who, spurred by his hatred of all that he considered as heresy, created the monastic order which was subsequently named after him, the Dominicans. In 1233, the Dominicans spawned the infamous institution which history records as the Holy Inquisition, which is sufficiently well known for us to leave the matter at that. Now, in looking back to the Pope's alarm at what was taking place in the Languedoc region, we see that there is more to the story than the people of this small principality rebelling against the authority of the Roman Church. And to appreciate this, again, we must go back to the story of Hildebrand, that is now Pope Gregory the VII, and his struggle with Henry the IV. Now, I know that we seem to have come a long, long way from Paul and the things which he did and which prompted me to call this series The Betrayal of Tomorrow. But if you will bear with me, I'd like to show how that the personality of Paul, plus of course his doctrine and theology, became a very real and tangible thing in the Roman Catholic Church, which is the organizational manifestation of the Jew Saul of Tarsus. In 1075, Gregory the Seventh, whom we have seen as being the second Jewish pope from the Peruglioni family, issued the most radical decree in church history, the Dictatus Papia, the papal dictatorship, which caused many an early commentator to declare that this declaration was an arrogant proclamation in which the pope appeared to confuse his own identity with that of God. Now this, of course, is precisely what Paul did, because when we consider how he ignored the teaching of the Christ of God and in many places reputed the doctrines which the Lord taught, we can see that Paul assumed a role and an identity which is reserved for God alone. However, in Gregory's decree, which contains some 27 rules which were taken exclusively from the Pauline epistles, one may see that the same ambition as motivated Paul motivated Gregory. And in looking at these 27 rules, one could almost imagine Paul standing behind Gregory dictating the document. Now, if we summarize the 13 Pauline epistles, we see that while Paul claimed to preach a gospel of freedom and reconciliation, he was, in point of fact, trying to establish control over the people, manipulating them to support him against the teaching of his rivals, the true apostles, which is very evident in the third epistle of John, verses 9 and 10. And in continuing, Paul attempted to dominate people and the churches with his doctrine to the exclusion of anything else. And finally, he attempted to alienate his converts from the real world in which they live. To Paul, patriotism, nationalism, racialism, or anything that has to do with the politics of life were anathema, concepts which had no place in his doctrine, which focuses exclusively on heaven, wherever that may be, and citizenship there. This, in a nutshell, is what Gregory the Seventh included in his 27 rules, although his concentration was more on the mechanisms whereby Paul's heavenly ideals could be realized. However, the same assumed authority as characterized the Pauline epistles may be seen in Gregory's decree, thus showing that the influence of Paul still lived on in those who, like Paul, assumed authority which was certainly not theirs. Gregory's 27 rules still obtain in the Roman Church, although many more have been added, all in similar vein and with more Pauline influence associated with them. Now, my friends, in looking at this tape, I see that we cannot go on very, very much further, and so I'm sorry that we must end this recording at this point. You see, there is so much more to tell, and so many facets of this great story that I would like to enlarge on. However, in our final part to the series, we will deal with the Reformation, the emergence of the Protestant churches, the social gospel, and the liberation theology, the Pauline doctrine of reconciliation in modern church teaching, and of course, the one world religious dream which is inherent in Judaism and, naturally enough, in the teaching of Saul of Tarsus.